Hi, I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. Tonight I have with us Dr. Edward Close, and we're going to talk about his book, Nature's Mold Prescription, The Non-Toxic Solution to Toxic Mold. And then hopefully before the end of the show, we'll get to talk a little bit about his book on consciousness, Transcendental Physics. How are you, Dr. Close?
I'm great. Glad to be with you.
Thanks for coming on my show. Wow, this is a really good book. I didn't follow the procedures exactly, but I did use the mold, and I haven't done the test because, you know, Atlanta had some really bad flooding a couple of months ago.
Yes.
But at least I have to say that something changed. So before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, how you got to do what you're doing, and where people can find you.
Okay. I started off as a scientist, undergraduate work in physics and mathematics, and then I did graduate work in theoretical physics, and then went into environmental engineering. And my PhD is actually in environmental engineering. And as a result of being an engineer and having worked for a number of years in several different states and so forth, long about 15 years ago, I started my own company and doing environmental consulting of a number of different kinds. And over that last 10 to 15 years, more and more of my consulting has been going toward helping solve problems, health problems that are caused by environmental factors. And that's how I really got started with solving problems of toxic mold with a non-toxic solution. And recently I've been appointed, Young Living Essential Oils has started a integrated health professionals council, and I'm one of the first, the five charter members of that council. So I'm working with MDs and have been for some time, and other PhDs, and have done a lot of research. And very quickly, the way we found the solution to toxic mold was an engineering problem that had a client that couldn't solve the mold problem. Had tried everything in the book. I mean, they had used everything from bleach to industrial strength fungicides, and nothing worked. They still had a problem. It was a 48 unit apartment complex, and my wife is a registered aromatherapist, and she suggested that some of the pure oils could actually, you know, that there were studies that showed that they killed mold. And so I said, well, get me some information. You know, I can't just go to an engineering client and say we're going to solve your problem with aromatherapy. And she laughed and said, well, don't call it that, you know. Tell them you've got an antifungal agent that really works. So I said, well, I don't know, you know. I have to figure out, I have to do some engineering here. I have to figure out how to apply it, and so that it'll be effective, and I've got to do before and after testing so that I know I'm doing something, because mold spores are microscopic. You can't see them. Many times you can't smell mold, and when you have high levels of mold spores in the air, because the smell comes from VOCs, volatile organic compounds, that are produced by the mold colonies at certain times in their cycles. And so just the fact that you smell or don't smell a moldy smell is not really a good indicator. That's why it's important. Well, there are a number of reasons it's important to do testing so you know what you're dealing with. And really, one of the big items here that we're trying to educate the medical profession, and there are a few out there, but they're growing in numbers, that this is an overlooked cause of many serious ailments. There are a lot of studies showing links between mold exposure and you name it, anything from cancer to heart disease to the common cold. And the reason my research has determined is not because mold spores cause all these things, but because of two things. Number one, mold exposure will reduce your immune system's ability to deal with other things. And two, mold spores, many of them, especially certain species, are large enough that bacteria and viruses can ride piggyback, and the mold spores will stay in the air much longer than bacteria and virus generally do, because they're just the nature of them. Like Aspergillus have shown that it can stay, once it's disturbed, it can stay in the air for 24 hours or longer. And so if you're exposed to the mold, it may not just be an allergenic reaction to the mold, which is always possible, or it may not just be toxins produced by the mold, but it may be also viruses and bacteria that work synergistically with the mold spores. So it's just a whole host of reasons why exposure to mold has been an overlooked element of health exposure and health problems in this country, because, and the world for that matter, because if you've been exposed to mold and you start getting some of the common symptoms, you go to your doctor. You don't take your house or your office in to the doctor's office with you. So he doesn't know you've been exposed to mold, and you may not know it either. And so you get misdiagnosed. You're given antibiotics, which will probably do no good at all for the mold exposure. And, it's a vicious cycle. Anyway, that's a long-winded answer to how I got involved.
I think it's very interesting. So let's just talk about Atlanta, for example. I mean, we had flooding so bad it was over some roofs of houses.
Mm-hmm.
How would you go about, what would be the first thing that you would do when you would come into a house?
Well, and we've been through this in some areas. There was one a couple of years ago, a 500-year return interval flood in a little town south of Indianapolis, Indiana. And we were asked to come over and help. And one of the things we found that, and I'm not really blaming anybody, but FEMA was out there saying, well, as soon as you can get back into your house, if you see any mold, clean it up with bleach, and we'll come by with a particle counter and tell you, whether we think it's safe for you to go in or not. And that's, in my mind, really negligent, because number one, a particle counter will tell you the number of spores maybe that are in the air, but it doesn't tell you whether you've got Stachybotrys, which could cause the healthiest adult in the world to come down violently ill after a few hours exposure, or some other more benign species that may cause irritation and so forth and respiratory problems, but not be life-threatening at least. So they don't know, and they're sending people back in. And the second thing is, should never use bleach on mold, even though we've all done it and we've all thought that that was the way to go. Doesn't kill the mold. It will bleach it out and kill the surface exposure, but if you've got a porous substrate that the mold's growing on, the bleach is 97% water, only about 3-4% sodium hypochlorite, which the reason for that is that you don't want it any stronger than that, or it's very hazardous to human health. and you don't want it to hang around. You want it to evaporate quickly, but the water remains, and if you have a porous surface, it soaks in, and within 24 hours, you get a rebound of the mold growth. So bleach is almost useless if you've got a mold problem.
What about food-grade hydrogen peroxide? Does that do anything for it?
It can. There are a number of things that can kill mold and mold spores, but peroxide has side effects too, because basically it's an oxidation agent, and there are some other things out there that people use for mold that also oxidize. And a couple of problems there. By the time you get to the strength, and ozone is one of those too that's commonly used, and that's what it provides extra oxygen, which oxidizes the mold. And one of the problems is by the time you get to the level to really be effective for a serious mold infestation, it's also injurious to human health and to some of your materials like leather upholstery and things like that.
So what would you, would use a kit and go in and test? Is that what you would do?
Yeah, I don't recommend the over-the-counter kits because they're so limited in what they tell you. You get a one spot. You can get a lot of false negatives and false positives with them. So really, if you suspect that you have a serious mold problem, about the only way you can really know what you're dealing with is to have a professional indoor air quality professional come in and take samples. You don't have to have them. That's one of the nice things about this solution we found. You don't have to have somebody come in and tear out all your walls and put in HEPA filters and, you know, run up $20,000 or $30,000 worth of cost. If you know what you're dealing with, you can set up a protocol that'll take care of it, and then just stop the source, which is excess moisture generally. So most of the time when you have mold, it's either from a flood, like you mentioned in Atlanta, or it's from pipe leaks or roof leaks or window leaks or condensation around pipes and things like that. So you eliminate the source, the excess moisture source. So back to your question about what would I do if I go to a flood site and there's a house, I would find out what I'm dealing with first, because it's kind of Russian roulette if you don't know what you're dealing with and you just go in and try to clean things up without proper protective equipment and a proper protocol to take care of the specific problem. And it varies so widely from house to house, even in a flooded area, because every house is unique in what it has for mold food. And if you have a flood and normally I would say what I've found, and I've done hundreds now of homes or buildings, office buildings and so forth, where there's been flooding or any kind of mold problem, that there are 10 to 15, sometimes even 20 different species of mold growing in a given house, and it can vary from room to room. I've seen situations where one room, it was relatively benign and actually looked worse, and an adjacent room where the carpet had been soaked, they had Stachybotrys, which is causing health problems in the house. So just from one room to the other, certainly from one floor to the other in a house, if you have a basement or even two floors above ground, it's very common to find totally different varieties of mold growing in different locations. So you really need to know what you're dealing with. And also, if you don't sample before and after, and I understand people's hesitation, you don't really know whether you've solved the problem or not. But if you've got the before and after, you've got the numbers there. And sometimes if the protocol doesn't solve the problem, and I have to tell you, that's rare that we've had that problem, then it's because there's another source that hasn't been identified, or in real rare cases, we may have to add a different oil or a different blend of oil for a resistant species of mold. So it's people are tempted to just say, oh, well, okay, if this will take care of the mold, I'll just start diffusing the oils and it'll take care of it. And it may well. It's certainly better than not doing anything if you suspect you have a mold problem.
So once you find out that the mold's there, like we were talking, you use essential oils to do this. How do you have some blends that you use, or you just, how do you decide what oil to use?
That's a good question. The way we discovered it, I mentioned the apartment complex. We used a blend, and I think we used two different blends that we tried, and a single oil that we knew from laboratory experiments was very effective on a number of different mold species, and that was thyme, the oil thyme. But the blend that turned out to be the most effective in this case, and we found it to be effective in about 99% of the cases since that time, was a blend called Thieves that's produced by Young Living Essential Oils. And it has five oils in it. It's a proprietary blend that Young Living makes, but it works so well that we use it in our own home. We diffuse. We have diffusers on timers, and there are a number of different ways you can use it. But we found that it's very effective about 99% of the time. Why not just do that if you feel you have a problem? The only reason I don't recommend it is if I have a client, I want them to be able to see that whatever we're using is effective because, as I said in the beginning, mold spores can't be seen by the naked eye. I've tested a home that had 53,000 plus mold spores per cubic meter, and it was an immaculate house. It looked like you couldn't believe there was a mold problem there. And the mold problem was in their central HVAC system, their heating and cooling system. But they were having health problems, but didn't know what the source was until when they found out it was mold. But they couldn't smell it. It didn't have a musty smell or anything. So
how do you diffuse it? Do you buy a special piece of equipment? And if you do, where do you get it?
Well, right
now. And how much does it cost?
Right now, the only place you can for sure get a diffuser set up that will work for mold problems is from EJC Enterprises, which is my company, my wife's company and mine. And we're trying to change that. We've been talking with the manufacturer of the diffusers and with Young Living Essential Oils to get them to produce a diffuser that will work specifically. I'm also working with some people on developing an industrial-sized one that we'd use in, like, warehouses and large office buildings. We've diffused in pretty large office buildings, but we've done that by going into the air handling system and putting the diffusers inside the air handling systems, and in most cases doing some local diffusing too in specific offices that where there's visible mold and that sort of thing. But the cost is about $150 for a setup to that, you know, has a size pump that will atomize the oils. The problem is atomizing the oils fine enough to almost molecular size, so that what they do is they engulf mold spore and dissolve it. We've done tests to show that this is what's happening, because they don't just kill, it doesn't just kill the mold spores and they fall out on the floor. There was some concern about that early on, because everybody in the mycologists and everybody, doctors, know that even dead mold spores will cause allergenic reactions. So the question was, well, if you're just killing the mold, where do those spores go? Well, the answer is that the oil engulfs the mold spore and dissolves it, so there's nothing left to to cause problems. And
so how does it work?
The
Can
diffuser?
You describe it? Yeah.
Yeah. What we recommend is that, depending upon the level of infestation, for instance, if you had a flooded house and you know you've got mold growing in the basement and you know you're working to get it cleaned up and get rid of the excess moisture, but you still know that you've got a big problem, whether you know how many thousand mold spores and what kind or not, if you have that kind of a situation, we recommend diffusing for at least 24 hours, and we've gone up to 72 hours in some cases where there was a high level. And you set up the diffuser that we've used and tested and ran the experiments on will take care of about 1,000 to 1,500 square feet of the normal home or office building space. Of course, it's going to be different if you have a warehouse and the ceiling's 20 feet up or something. But for normal space, it'll take care of about 1,000 to 1,500 square feet. And you diffuse for at least 24 hours, and that's kind of like a shock treatment to a pool, for example. After that, we found one of the really great things about this protocol is it has what I call a residual effect. We've tested homes and buildings up to 3 months after doing that shock treatment of 24, 48, or 72 hours of diffusing, and found that the levels were still very low inside, in spite of the fact that they might be high on the outside. So, different than most of the things that are used, which whether it's bleach or industrial fungicide or ozone or any other method that I know of, doesn't have the residual effect, because it's usually harmful to human health, so you don't want it hanging around. Whereas with this, before we discovered this use, this oil was used therapeutically. It was used in by doctors for certain respiratory problems and things like that.
So why would you not be able to just put it in one of those oil burners and burn it so that it goes into the air?
Very good question. The main reason is heat breaks down the compounds that are in essential oils. A given essential oil, like, let's just say, lavender, has 157 different organic compounds, natural organic compounds, in it. And they all work together. And if you heat it, while you will still get fragrance, you will break down many of the compounds, and they won't do the same thing, they won't be as effective. So we don't recommend using heat.
Could you, if somebody's suffering symptoms, and I know you're not a medical doctor, but I'm asking this anyway, could you take some, like, thieves oil and put a drop or two on the soles of your feet? You know, because your feet have all those meridians and everything.
Right. I have worked with and am working with, you know, people in alternative health care modalities like Vitaflex and Reiki and massage therapy and things like that. And the short answer is yes, it will be effective for most people. What we've found in the people that I'm working with found is that you really need to be careful and there are several things to take into consideration. First of all, you want what's called therapeutic grade essential oils. And they're kind of hard to come by. A lot of the oils that you get in, like, a local health food store are not pure essential oils. Quite often they have a carrier oil, and many times it may be mostly carrier oil. And the worst case is sometimes there are synthetic oils in there, and they won't have the same effect as the natural oils. I'll give you a quick example. Lavender, again, has a lot of health benefits for people. A lot of times the lavender oil that you get in a health food store, because they're produced for spas and things like this, will be quite a bit cheaper than pure essential oils, but they'll have lavandin instead of lavender, and lavandin still has a similar aroma, but it doesn't have the same therapeutical value.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, real lavender is very good for treating a burn. They found that out in France, World War II, and there are doctors there. In France, in fact, you have to be a medical doctor to pretty much to use essential oils for health purposes. But they found that if there's lavandin in the mixture, and this is, you know, this is what makes it kind of tricky. You go to your local health food store or someplace and you get a lavender oil and it happens to have lavandin in it, it'll actually make a burn worse instead of making it
better.
Interesting.
So why could you not just put some... Well, I'll tell you what I did, and I know it's not the best way to do it, or maybe even the right way, but I was kind of desperate. Right after our flood, my wrists and my knees started killing me, and I didn't know what to do. And, you know, my friend Susan Kolb, you were on her show one time, she told me about you. She's a medical doctor here in Atlanta. And she said, well, thieves oil will get rid of mold. And I know we knew we had mold down here because we had that bad flood in my basement anyway. So, I wanted something immediately because my wrists, I type at work, and they were just killing me. So I got all the water out, and I got a dehumidifier. But then I got a humidifier, and I bought some very pure essential oils that you described to make thieves oil, and I put it in my humidifier, but ran my dehumidifier at the same time. And whether it was good or bad, my wrists and my knees stopped hurting. That's all I know to say. And it stopped smelling. Now, whether there's any more, you know, I don't know yet, but I want to get one of your diffusers. But that's what I did. So why would that not work?
Well, it might not work given certain species of mold in certain situations, but in general, what you did certainly would be a lot better than doing nothing, and could be quite effective. Like I said, the only way you really know is by sampling before and after to get, you know, as you'll notice in the book, I calculated the efficiency of the diffusing on the different species. in each case. And
so you don't think I did any harm to myself breathing that in like that?
No, no,
oh,
I wouldn't think so. If you had good, great oils, pure oils, I wouldn't think so at all, and I would expect that you would have probably experienced some benefits from it.
Well, it did make my wrist stop hurting, which I was so grateful for. I was shocked because I was such a skeptic, but it only took for a few days for it to do it. So how would we get it out of our air duct system?
There are professional cleaners who will clean, although I found here in the area we're in the Mississippi River Valley, so we have a lot of high humidity days here and flooding on occasion and a lot of moisture and a lot of mold. I found that most of the companies that do the cleaning, if they find out that you have mold or that you know you have or very seriously suspect that you do, they won't actually clean your ducts. They'll say, no, not until you do something about the mold. What we do in the case where we know that it's in the air handling system is we get the diffuser, and sometimes this is easier than other times depending on how the air conditioning and heating system set up. That's why I'm hoping that at some point we'll get somebody who will manufacture a unit that can be more or less just plugged into a heating and air conditioning system without too much trouble. But we've managed to put diffusers inside air handling systems. We did a State Department of Transportation office building that was almost a new building, but it was one of these flat roof buildings, and it leaked from the day it was built, I think. And anyway, we put diffusers right into the air handling systems. In your own home, where that might be a little more difficult if you're not a handy person or you don't have a handy husband or friend who can come in and figure out ways to do it, by taking off panels on the near the A coil in the air conditioning system, because that's where most of the mold problems start in an AC or HVAC system, is in around the A coil in the air conditioner, because that's where the moisture collects. And if the little tube that drains the pan under the A-coil gets stopped up, you get mold growing in that pan. And sometimes it comes right up the tube from a basement floor drain and gets into the whole system. So if you can't get in there to the heart of the problem, you can diffuse the oils right next to a return register. The closest one, if you can figure that out, the one that's nearest to the central system, and diffuse set the diffuser so that the nebulizer is right practically against the grill of the return register, and run it for at least 24, but probably more like 48 hours, and so you get the oils pull through the entire system. Other people have put the oils on cotton balls and put them in the return air, so it's pulling the oils in. I don't think that's as effective. I've even cleaned some, including our own, systems by using the Thies Household Cleaner, which is another product of Young Living's that has the same oil blend in it. And I guess I should mention, you asked me earlier how they would get in touch with us. Our website is www.moldrx4, that's the number 4, and the letter U, moldrx4u.com. And we have an e-store and everything you can get. We have protective clothing for doing cleanup of mold problems and the diffuser. And we don't. You can also get a whole kit through that. What we try to do, if people want to continue diffusing or to use the oils in their own home, we set them up with a wholesale account so they can order the products directly from the company, so that they don't have to go through us every time they want something. Otherwise, you know, we would be so overwhelmed. We have been since the book went out anyway with a lot of calls.
Now, how would you do it in a car that has mold? Just do you run the diffuser in there, or what do you do?
Yeah, that's a good question too. And we've had that problem. We've had people say they even sold their cars or got rid of them because every time they get in the car and turn the AC on, they would start having problems from breathing the mold. And it's just like the house. It depends on what kind of mold got started in there. If it's and depends on the person's sensitivity to it also. But what we do with ours, if we spill something in the car, water gets in, we leave it out in the driveway and the rain blows in or something and it gets wet. Anything like that where we think, you know, we've got a either have or a potential for a mold problem, we just we pull the car into the garage and put a diffuser right in it with an extension cord, you know, mm-hmm. and run it overnight, you know, for two or three nights, maybe just to make sure we get it saturated.
How much oil does a diffuser hold?
That's a good question. We're also working with the manufacturer, and we've got one that we're testing now that will hold a 15 milliliter bottle. The ones that typically that we sell and that Young Living sells, the smaller ones that they sell, only hold about a third of a 15 milliliter bottle, or about 5 milliliters. And with the pump size that we have to have for the mold remediation, it will drain that in about 8 hours. So you have to, if you're going to do a 24-hour job of diffusing, you have to fill it up three times. And,
okay.
That's kind of a bother. So that's why we're trying to get the manufacturer to come up with something that will really work, that will hold at least one bottle, because that's about 24 hours with the diffusion rate that we use.
And what do you think, this might not be the right word, but what do you think the half-life is? I mean, how long will a treatment last?
Based on our tests that we've done, in almost any kind of circumstances, a treatment will last a month, because even in those apartment complexes where after we did the initial diffusing and testing before and after, that was one of the questions the client brought up. He said, well, you know, this is great, but we've tried everything else and the mold keeps coming back. What if it does that with this method? We're no better off, even though we had brought the levels way down, lower than they had been able to. And I, at the time, I said, you know, I don't know. I'll come back when I can schedule it and don't do any more testing. Well, during that time, they were still doing renovations. So they had, some of the apartments had the doors off or windows out, maybe just covered with a sheet of plastic so rain wouldn't get in, and workers going in and out doing, you know, plumbing and wiring and so forth. Even under those circumstances, 2 weeks later, the levels were lower in the apartments we tested than they were right after we did the diffusing, even though the outdoor levels were plenty high. And So with others that we've done, that was the first one, it's going to vary some from situation to situation, but in general, a month or two, and we've seen, as I think I mentioned before, one up to 3 months later, the levels were still way down from what you would normally expect with the ambient conditions that were there on the outside.
Interesting. So how long does one of these, what do you call that little, the nebulizer thing, how long does it, or the diffuser, how long does it last?
We've got diffusers still running that we used in the same time that we did those initial tests in late 2006 and 2007. So we've got diffusers that have been running for 3 years or more,
okay,
and they're still working fine. Now, I would have to say that we've had some problems with pumps occasionally starting to make more noise and have a reduced output, and we've replaced a few pumps where that's happened.
Okay. All right, we've got about 15 minutes left. Do you want to talk about consciousness for a few minutes, or is there anything else you want to make sure we cover about this?
I think we've done a pretty good job. Yeah, I would love to talk about consciousness. That's my favorite. Even when I was back in college as a physics math major, I was really interested and thought that the real frontier of science was the mind-matter interface problem.
It is my passion.
Yeah.
It and alternative medicines are my passion. So I have some questions I'm going to ask you. I have like a set of 20 questions when I spend an hour talking to some scientists about consciousness, but we won't have time to do all of them, but I'll ask you a few. First
okay.
of all, what is your definition of consciousness? Because I tell you what, as many times as I ask the questions, I get that many different answers, so I think it's important that we find some way to make sure we're all talking about the same thing, the scientists in particular.
Yeah, in my definition, and you probably get a sense of it if you read Transcendental Physics, I don't think of consciousness as just awareness. Awareness is a function of consciousness, not a definition. I think of consciousness as the operator or the cause of negative entropy. That's in physics terms.
That's a good way to put it. I call it the ground of all being because I don't know what else to call it, but that's my way of encompassing everything. But that's a good way to put it. So, what is mind to you? What's your definition of mind?
Mind, I think, has, you know, just because of the traditional use of that word, means generally mental function or functioning of the brain, which has been likened to a computer, and the materialistic minded scientists are working really hard to try to explain consciousness, what philosopher David Chalmers calls the hard problem of consciousness, in terms of brain dynamics. I wrote a paper recently which was published in an international journal. The title was, Can Consciousness Be Explained in Terms of Quantum Brain Dynamics? And the brief answer is no, not at our level of knowledge right
now.
What
do you mean, conscious quantum brain dynamics? I've never heard that phrase before.
Well, at the quantum level, because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, there is a level of uncertainty about how things manifest at the quantum level, and that's at the elementary particle level. And electrons and photons are both elementary particles. So I talk about this in Transcendental Physics, the the EPR paradox and Bell's theorem and so forth, where quantum physics actually proves that these elementary particles don't actually exist like little baseballs or little planetary systems the way we used to think of it, but they only come into existence when they impact on a receptor.
I understand that, but what I don't understand is the relationship to brain that you just made.
Okay. In the brain, I believe that if it weren't for quantum uncertainty, so-called, if it weren't for that element at the quantum level where the electrons are going through the synapses and the neurons to and pulses to form thoughts and so on and so forth, we would be biological automatons. The only reason we have choice and free will, and I've written a paper about this, is because of quantum uncertainty. So brain dynamics at the quantum level opens the door to free will or the ability to make a choice. And otherwise, we would be. You could show that determinism would work from the top to the bottom, and basically everything we do would be programmed like in a computer, and
right.
That's not the case.
I have two questions. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Go ahead.
I have two questions here, and we don't have but about 10 minutes. The first one, and let me ask them both first so you can determine how much time you want to spend, okay? The first
okay.
one, maybe three questions. I kind of thought there was, in my opinion, big mind and little mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to know, do you think that the brain thinks? And then I want to know, free will is one of my things I think about a lot. And when I first had, I don't know if you know anything about me, but I had like this spontaneous enlightenment thing that happened to me. You just have to read my website, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, I woke up, and I know you know what I mean by that phrase.
I do.
And so at first, I thought that I had free will and I could intend anything that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But then my teacher said to me one day, Eva, you're not driving the car. You can't manifest anything you want. It's like you're a two-year-old strapped in a car seat in the back seat, and your car seat has a little yellow steering wheel, and you think that you're driving that car, but really God's in the front, or whatever you want to call it, source or God or whatever your word for that is in the front seat. You come down to the stop sign, and the playground's on the right, and the store's on the Kroger's on the left, and God's going to Kroger, and you want to go to the playground. Whose steering wheel you think is going to work? So it made me realize I really don't have complete free will. I have free will to place an intention, but I don't have free will to make sure that intention occurs. So there's all your questions.
Okay.
You got eight or nine minutes.
Okay. Big mind and little mind, all these work together. Does the brain think? Short answer is the brain, if the brain's defined as the physical structure, the gray matter and so forth that make up the physical brain, the answer is no. It has the capability, like a computer, of comparing. It has memory. It compares constantly with the input from your eyes, ears, and nose, and hands in terms of electronic pulses. Again, it processes those things, but it does not think, in my opinion. And big mind, little mind, in transcendental physics, you'll see that what I prove through quantum physics is that there had to be a primary consciousness in existence prior to the time the first particle came out of the Big Bang. Otherwise, we'd have no universe here.
Mm-hmm.
So the big mind is the primary consciousness, which pervades everything and gives everything its form and structure. Without it, you know, the ideas physicists say, Michio Kaku has said on his programs that we're just debris from a big explosion 14 billion years ago. That's baloney. Whoever saw an explosion that created anything? To create something as complex as a human being, just the physical human being, or an ant for that matter, for an explosion to do that would be like expecting a tornado to go through a junkyard and create a Boeing 747 in transit. It just won't happen. And so there is a pervasive, as you said, the ground of all things, the matrix out of which everything comes, the void from which all manifestations arise, through the distinctions drawn by individual consciousness and primary consciousness, is what creates the world. And let's see, that's...
I asked about free will, but now I have another question. Where do you think little mind resides? Does it reside in our aura, in the electromagnetic field around us and through us? Does it reside in the brain? What do you think it is?
Well, we're finding more and more that it doesn't reside. I have friends at the University of Arizona who are working on, maybe you've heard of Stuart Hameroff and Roger Penrose. They're working on, they think that the microtubules in the brain, these very minuscule structures, may be the seat of consciousness. The problem with that is that even at brain function, we know that if one part of the brain is injured, another part can start doing the function that was done by that part that was injured many times. So this idea of there being a place, we also know that there's, I'll give you an example. I learned to do the Rubik's Cube while I was stranded in Saudi Arabia during Ramadan one year. And then years later, I picked up a Rubik's Cube, and I tried to remember all the routines. And as long as I tried with my brain to remember the routines, I couldn't do it. But when I just sat there and let my hands do the job, kind of like riding a bicycle, my hands knew the routines and solved the Rubik's Cube. So consciousness or brain function is not really confined to one point. This is one of the problems, I think, with modern psychology. They think that you can only be aware of one distinct object at a time, and I know for a fact that's not the case. You can be aware of your entire body from your toes to the top of your head all at the same time. And the consciousness has that ability. And so it doesn't, it's not like a little man sitting up in the brain in a control point. We're finding more and more that there are computers in every cell in our bodies that do the same functions or similar functions to what we used to think were all had to be in the brain or the central nervous system.
I really think that, and I've never really said this to anybody, and I've interviewed probably 100 people, physicists, about this. For some reason, I'm convinced that the individual consciousness is that field around us. And I think that the microtubules and everything else reads that somehow or gets infiltrated by it somehow.
Are you familiar with Rupert Sheldrake's idea?
The morphic field.
Yes. And I think that comes closer, and I would agree with you that it's more of a field. And we know from really very definitive experiments in parapsychology with remote viewing and things like that, that the consciousness of an individual is only restricted to a certain area for specific reasons to be able to function in the world and to stay in the vehicle that we have called the body and the brain. but the consciousness is more, would be more properly defined as a field than as a structure.
I think so too. I don't find many people that really get what I'm saying when I do say that, but there has, I just can't imagine that, since, I can't imagine how consciousness can be contained in little finite things.
Right. I'm working with an MD, PhD. He's the founder of a neuropsychological institute out in Seattle. We're working on some ideas that will eventually produce a couple of books, I think. And we're kind of in that minority of a few small percentage of scientists right now who are working in that direction to help understand consciousness as the source. We should be, as I say in transcendental physics, trying to explain matter and energy in terms of consciousness, not consciousness in terms of matter and energy.
Absolutely, yeah, I totally agree. So we got about 1 or 2 minutes left. Do you want to comment on the free will thing?
Yeah, I took some examples of tracing the ideas of consciousness in the paper on quantum brain dynamics and ask the questions, okay, at what point do we have free will? We have free will, and again, I'll just jump, since I don't have much time, to my opinion is that we may have free will for about 25% of what we do. About 75% of what we do is pre-programmed or determined by what you call the big mind rather than the little mind.
Yeah, I did too. All right, tell us again where to find you.
Two websites, www.moldrx4u.com and www.transcendentalphysics.com. And that's where you can
find me. If anybody wants to email you, can they do that?
Yes, I get a lot of emails. I try to answer all of them that are serious and have good questions. It may take a little while sometimes, but yes, they can email me at eclose@closeenvironmental.com or eclose@ejcenterprises.com.
And that's CLOSE, Close.
That's correct, yes.
Thank you, Dr. Close, for coming on my show, and thank you for finding this, what you've done. It's wonderful, and I'm sure it's going to save a lot of people a lot of sickness and a lot of money. Thank you, and I hope you'll come back when your new book comes out.
Thank you, Eva, for having me on. I always enjoy talking to somebody who understands what I have to say.
Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health.
Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.